You're right.
Okay, it's July 30th, 2010. We're at the offices of Covington and Berlin at 1201 Pennsylvania Avenue in Washington, D.C. at 9 a.m. To interview Mr. Angus McBride. And just for the record, why don't we have everybody identify themselves, please?
Rob Kilmer with Covington and Berlin.
Jessica Richmond-Smith with Friedman Kaplan Silent.
Brian Smith, Covington and Berlin.
Art Wilmark, FCIC.
Chris Seifer, FCIC.
Bruce McWilliams, FCIC.
Okay, and so you're with a different law firm. Do you represent Mr. McBride? Or?
I represent Wells Fargo and Wachovia.
Okay. Mr. McBride, thank you for coming today. I appreciate it. We are with the Financial Crisis Inquiry Commission. We were established by a statute last year called the Fraud Enforcement and Recovery Act that tasked us with, in a whopping year no less, to figure out the causes of the financial crisis and to look at, amongst other things, every financial institution that failed or would have failed but for the receipt of government assistance. Told us to look at issues of things like too big to fail, which I mentioned because that is somewhat the context of what we're looking at Wachovia in, since at least initially the FDIC invoked the systemic risk exception of fiducia to approve Citi's assisted bid that we know now was not necessary because Wells subsequently made an unassisted bid. So I want to ask you, as I suspect your counsel told you, primarily about your job there in terms of liquidity management at the company. But before we get to that, could you please just summarize your educational and work background since college?
So graduated from Washington Lee, 1984, economics degree. Started work with First Union January of 85, which continued through my departure February 2009.
Okay, remind me when Wachovia purchased First Union.
That would have been April 2001, I believe. And actually, I can't remember if it was First Union Wachovia or the way around.
That's it was First Union Wachovia, right.
Okay, and then can you take me through your, I mean, I don't know that I need 24 years of your positions at the bank.
Okay.
But I want to talk to you about your positions in the area of liquidity. So maybe you can take me through your positions at least once they start being in the liquidity area.
Okay. So I can be brief. The first 8 years, commercial lending, and started on the funding desk in January of 93. In junior roles, moving up to run the funding desk, and then moving off the funding desk in 2007 into a treasury finance position with the funding desk reporting to me. And there I was in charge of funding, the execution of funding plans, and liquidity risk management.
When was that?
It's a little blurry. I was always in funding and liquidity risk management. When that became my responsibility is probably in the beginning of 2008 when I picked up the liquidity risk management function directly from a person who had just recently left.
But when you moved from the various funding positions to heading up the Treasury Department in 2007, do you recall the month?
I was part of Treasury.
Okay.
So I worked for the Treasurer in charge of funding and liquidity risk management. So I left the funding desk proper, the trading floor, at the end of 2006.
Okay. So what's your title when you're working for the in the Treasury Department?
Senior Vice President in charge of liability management, I think is what was on my business card.
Okay, and then who did you report to?
The treasurer in 2007 was Jim Burr, and he left in the summer of 2008. And then I worked for the interim treasurer, Greg Norwood.
Do you know the circumstances of Mr. Burr's departure in the summer of 08?
Not precisely, no.
Did he resign? Do you know? Was he fired?
I don't know how to characterize that, actually.
Tell me what you do know.
He did not retire, and he chose to pursue other opportunities with Carlisle Capital, I believe, is who he went to go work for.
Okay. Okay, so describe to me generally your job responsibilities once you move from the funding desk into the Treasury Department responsible for funding and liquidity risk management.
They would be funding, so accessing the wholesale funding markets, planning how to do that, debt issuances, wholesale certificate deposit sales, and the liquidity risk management function, which is understanding how we do that and manage the risk embedded in it. It would include things like managing the Federal Reserve accounts, collateralized lending like repurchase funding, Federal Home Loan borrowings,
when we're talking about wholesale funding, is that considered everything but the core deposits?
Core and non-core deposits, to be precise. So wholesale funding would be any type of funding where you're relying on credit-sensitive investors.
Okay. So does wholesale funding then not include broker deposits?
Broker deposits would be a little bit of both. It's maybe sold to retail customers, but through an intermediary.
Okay. So, you know, one of the things we're interested in understanding at Wachovia is just one sort of seeing what the weekly, monthly, quarterly funding composition was, liability composition was. And then what happened, particularly with a focus on sort of June of 08 forward, or at least July of 08 forward, because that's when you guys reported the $9 billion loss for the second quarter of 2008. And from some documents I've seen, that seems to have been a time when liquidity started to become more of an issue. So can you first describe to me how you guys, I won't strike that, can you first describe to me the reports that existed that would show us what the company's liquidity position was on either a daily, weekly, or monthly basis?
Yes. The liquidity report, which was a monthly prepared and distributed package, laid out the funding needs of the company on a go-forward basis anywhere from 12 to maybe 18 months.
And is that this? Have you seen a report like this before? And for the record, for the poor sap typing up the transcript, this is a report, I believe, as of July 31st, 2008.
With the title Monthly Liquidity Report.
And if you want to, Rob, you can state the Bates number since I don't have it in front of me.
2087. Okay, I'll look through the documents. Yeah, this would be the monthly liquidity report that the liquidity committee would review once a month.
Did you put this report together?
No, I would not have assembled this. I would have had an analyst who did that.
But, I mean, you were responsible for it, though. I mean,
I would have looked at the work that he completed.
So earlier you mentioned that there were these monthly reports that were part of a package, and you just mentioned that there was a liquidity committee. Is there more that goes to strike that? Does the liquidity committee meet monthly, I take it?
Yes, it is monthly. That's the regularly scheduled meetings.
Right, and there may be more frequent meetings that aren't regularly scheduled, I take it, at times.
There could be more frequent meetings.
Who's on the liquidity committee? In this 2008 time period?
Myself, members of my staff. I don't recall exactly who the required attendees were. Somebody from the forecasting team in Treasury, the treasurer, somebody from the investment portfolio, part of the balance sheet management, and other from time to time invited guests.
It's a management committee?
It's a management committee. I believe, I recall that it was chartered under Asset Liability Committee.
Okay. Are there any members of the Board of Directors on the committee?
No, they're not.
Okay. Do you guys report to the Board of Directors during Board of Directors meetings?
The Liquidity Committee did not.
Okay. Does the ALCO committee make a presentation at board meetings, do you know?
I don't know.
Okay. Who gets the monthly liquidity report? I assume everybody on the Liquidity Committee gets the monthly liquidity report.
Yes.
Okay. Does anybody else?
I don't recall who besides the attendees would have received the report.
Okay. Now, this monthly liquidity report that goes to at least liquidity committee members, what else goes to them, if anything, besides this monthly report? Is this part of a package, or is this...
I think that's... I recall that being the package that was distributed to the attendees.
Okay. If it's the primary material, at least, that's delivered. Maybe there's some extraneous materials that come in addition to this. There's not, like, a narrative?
There's primary... That is the primary material. There may be extraneous, and there were minutes prepared from the Liquidity Committee meeting.
Okay. Is there an agenda prepared for the meeting?
I believe there was an agenda prepared in conjunction with every meeting.
We'll mark those.
I figured that was the next comment.
Okay. Other than the monthly liquidity report, what other types of at least regular reports are there in terms of managing the companies and monitoring the company's liquidity position? And just so we're clear, that means funding and whatever else.
Yes. Okay. I don't recall any other reports generated that were used to plan funding or liquidity.
Okay. Then I think what I want to do, and if you don't mind, I'm going to come over there. So I only brought one copy. And just sort of have you walk me through this and make sure I'm understanding it correctly, if that's... As I said, that's all right with you guys as I move my chair over here. So if we can maybe just, you don't need to explain the cover page, and that's clear.
Okay.
But as we go to page one, it's simply titled Additional Funding Projection Information. So if you can, just explain to me what this page is telling us. And I don't mean specifically. I just mean you don't have to say, well, that number, that we're projecting $12.5 billion of funding needs for the month of August.
Okay. I think that the positive number would be funding not needed.
Okay.
Until you get to the negative, which would be funding needed.
Okay.
I
So funding surplus.
Funding surplus.
Okay, so explain to me then, I mean, when we're looking at this page, we see this revised July 31, 2008 funding projection, for example, 12 and a half, and by the way, it doesn't have millions here, but I'm assuming this is billions of dollars, right? 12.5 billion, right?
Mm-hmm.
How do we get from the 12.5 billion to the negative 144 million?
From looking at this, I think the items that immediately below are included in the 731.08 funding projection. So it looks to me like it's embedded in that number.
In that 7056 number?
Yes.
Okay. And so when I'm looking at this, then given what you said, does this mean as of July, as of August 31, 2008, well, actually, tell me what it means. Does it mean that you project that you need $144 million, you need to come up with $144 million of funding?
No, I read this to mean that the $144 million out use of cash is embedded in that number.
Okay.
So the funding surplus would be that number.
Okay. And so as we move down then, all right, so this is just like a subsidiary schedule to this.
Yeah.
Okay.
Supplemental.
Gotcha, right. And then as we move along to the other to the subsequent months, obviously we move from a on the top line here or the bottom line from a positive 12.5 billion to a negative 43.9 billion. What does that mean?
All right, I think that's a cumulative, but I'm not sure. And so this would say that by year end 08, that much funding from somewhere will be needed.
Okay. And then we're going to go through the next pages, but I take it the next pages are going to sort of explain to me the why of this, the assumptions behind and why we think we're going to go from being $12.5 billion surplus to a $44 billion need.
We'll see. I
just had a question on the top line, which is the funding projection line. Is it fair to say that those are essentially internally generated funds, or are they the accumulated funding position of the entire bank, you know, moving forward? In other words, I notice that down below you say you're looking at the Federal Home Loan Bank advances, which are external funds. This is sort of like a net positive funding position of the whole bank, and then I guess internal operations are either creating or drawing away funds.
We'll have to see as we go through the package. I think that's right, but you know, that's this is just the summary at this point.
Right.
Okay. So let's. All right. So take me through page 3.
Lot of information. We'll kind of take this one line at a time.
And if you are familiar with the report and it makes sense to not go in numerical order of the pages, that's fine.
Okay.
I just want to make sure we're understanding the report correctly.
Okay. The disadvantage I have is just haven't been through it in about 2 years. So on line 7, this would represent, I think, the amount of overnight money that would be needed to balance the Fed accounts.
And when you say Fed accounts, the Fed funds accounts, or the please balance the Fed accounts? I mean, that's what are those exactly?
To balance the books to have a this much funding would be needed to be
to sort of have a zero cash position. Okay.
Yes.
Right. Okay. Thank you. So, yeah, no, to clear all your obligations through the Fed clearing system and so on. Yeah. Right. Okay.
Policy required that overnight borrowings be limited to $20 billion. So line 9 would be the amount of term funding needed in order to stay compliant with the $20 billion policy limit.
Mm-hmm. And you'd had you were required to exceed that policy at the end of 2008, it looks like. You had to go to 22.7? Or am I reading that wrong?
I would say that the funding plan needs to be executed in such a way that you're not reliant on any more than $20 billion. Therefore, you need to have source liquidity from somewhere of $39 million by the end of 2009.
Right.
I think lines 11 through 14 are footnotes on how much term funding is maturing that will need to be replaced.
In the London line, that's essentially the Eurodollar market that you were borrowing in, or?
Let's see. I don't see that yet.
Oh, the big number 3.
Yeah, we're not even down to number 2 yet.
Okay.
I think he meant this.
Okay. Oh, big 3.
Yeah.
Big 3. Okay.
You're going to have to wait.
Okay. So 19 is how much, again, restates the
right
amount of term funding needed.
But at the 12/31/09, you're projecting you need to have $59 billion. If there's a $20 billion overnight fund limit, you need to come up with $39.
That's it.
But this also says that you need $19 billion on September 30th in term funding, or that you'll have a surplus. They need to issue $18.9 billion. That seems like what it says.
We'll have to take a look at additional pages. There is a concept there that addresses baseline funding and stress testing funding. So I think that'll become clearer later in the package.
Okay, but given your explanation before, I mean, when we were looking at 12/31/09, you were saying this is a projection of funds that are going to be needed, and there's a $20 billion limit, so we're going to need $39, and I didn't, thank you, Bruce, I didn't notice this, but in the beginning, we're looking actually at negative numbers, so it can't be the same explanation, can it? I mean, if nothing else, the math doesn't appear to be working.
I think these numbers are funding surplus.
All right.
And this number here relates to the difference between baseline funding, which is in a normal operating environment, not what's needed after you run the stress test.
Okay.
So I think we'll see that is related to how much is needed to keep compliant with the stress testing objectives, which rule how much short funding you have.
Okay. So then big line 2, holding company issuance projection. Explain that to me, and it, to the extent it relates, explain.
Yep. The distinction there is the holding company and the bank as separate legal entities need to access funding separately.
Right.
So actually, I don't know if two is part of one, but it's in here. So when we think about how much funding the bank will need, we have to also carry along how much the holding company will need as well.
Because you were funding your, for example, your securities broker dealer and so on through the holding company, and they were funding. You had separate funding needs for your holding company subsidiaries that needed to be met separately?
Yes. The holding company issues manages its own funding as a separate legal entity for whatever its funding needs are.
I had a question about the stress testing. You mentioned that you were looking at sort of a baseline scenario and a stress test scenario. To the extent you remember, were the stress tests something that was started, say, around 2007? And that hadn't been there before, or were you always stress testing as long as you were in Treasury, as far as you recall?
I recall stress testing predated my arrival at the funding desk.
And if you recall, do you recall whether the stress test scenarios got more progressively more severe? You know, the assumptions got progressively more, you could say, pessimistic as you moved from 2007 to 2008?
I would say it like this: the results got more pessimistic. The structure of stress testing, I don't recall it really changing.
Right.
It had
just four the inputs began to change. You mean the inputs you were getting from your forecasting team or whatever?
The inputs changed, and as a result, the output, not as much as the policy framework.
Okay. Thank you.
For example, we've seen, I think, in an August 2008 OCC letter where they came to the institution, you know, saying we're downgrading you guys, but we're leaving liquidity at a 2, but it's still high risk. And I believe it said in there, I didn't bring it, we know you guys are now stress testing for a couple of severe possible ratings downgrades because the rating agencies either had put you guys on watch or whatever. Remember, 2Q08, of course, was the $8.9 billion net loss that was reported that made some people take a closer look, I suppose. Does that jog any memory bells in terms of changes in either scenario analyses or inputs to those analyses at that time? Sort of post 2Q08 earnings release.
The policy required that we identify what sort of operating environment the company was in, and there were various stages discussed in the liability management contingency funding plan, and with the possibility of a downgrade associated with the Q2 earnings release, we activated the next stage in that plan, which was, you know, get ready for the implications of a downgrade.
So is it sounds like, and tell me if I'm misstating this, that you have a liquidity plan that projects out what you think the needs are going to be, and that's sort of your baseline. And then in addition to that, you stress test that and run scenario analyses for possible events occurring.
The baseline is correct, and there are three stages, three scenarios in the stress test that are progressively more severe on the company. The activation of that's independent. That stress testing is independent of the activation of the staging, which put in place executive management's attention on the possibility of downgrading implications.
Okay. But for every month, when you go into your liquidity meetings every month and you have these reports, and maybe we'll even see these scenario analyses in these reports. I haven't looked at them that closely. I just want to make sure I get the process generally, whether it's in the report or not. You have your reports that provide the baseline best estimate of what the liquidity needs are going to be. And then, as I think I just heard you, there's three different levels of stress tests that are done to that.
Baseline, yes. Scenario 2, 3, and 4, which are the three progressively more severe scenarios, those are done on a quarterly basis in part of the quarterly package. So the monthly, which we're looking at here, is the baseline, and the quarterly is the stress test check on, safety and soundness.
So would the quarterly report that you're talking about be similar to this plus the scenario analyses, or is it just the scenario analyses, or is it something else?
It would be both. It would be the baseline, and then extracted from the baseline would be the results of the progressively more severe stress tests.
Okay. If we don't have them, we want those. And we may. I don't know. But you know, I think, if we have them.
and I guess just to clarify so I understand the staging bit, what was the management telling you, okay, we want to go from 2 to 3 or 3 to 4, or were they actually telling you we want to go from 2, 3, and 4 to something else? In other words, I wasn't quite clear what the management shift was when after the second quarter earnings. Did they just say, okay, now we want to focus on scenario 3 or scenario 4, or did they say, you know what, we're going to actually shift the assumptions in the scenarios, and they're going to look different because we're ratcheting it up? I just wanted to clarify whether that was happening.
Okay, a lot of questions there. The policy framework sets out the definitions of the stress test. That's done quarterly. And that's part of the funding policy. Separate from the funding policy, which addresses the stress testing, is something called a liability management contingency funding plan, which outlines the stages in which the company is operating.
Okay, right, so if you could explain that a little bit more for us.
Okay, from memory, the stage one would be normal operating environment, and there were subsequent stages, each more severe in their description of both name specific stress and industry systemic. Therefore, so in preparation of, not in response to, the possibility of a downgrade with Q2 earnings release, the next stage was initiated.
And did that sort of change then either the parameters or the inputs to the stress tests? I mean, what they look like at that point, that the components began to change because you moved to a stage of higher risk?
It did not change the quarterly stress testing that was done. It required more work on the part of me and my staff to make more information available to those who were going to review it.
Thank you.
And I apologize for being thick, but just so I know I'm clear, in the normal course, pre-2Q8, 2Q08 earnings release anyway, you've got your baseline and your three stress tests done in, I assume, stage one normal operating environment. And then after 2Q08, does management say, okay, now give me the funding plan and the three scenario analyses, but under a stage two analysis, since we're in a heightened state, for lack of a better term? Is that, am I just generally understanding that correctly?
It's hard to be general about
then don't
that. Okay. The Asset Liability Committee would review monthly the liquidity condition. I'm sorry, I don't know if that was monthly or quarterly as a standing operating procedure. It would review periodically the funding needs of the company, and it would see the results of the stress test. And that was in a normal operating environment. It would see the funding plan, it would see the results of the stress test. And if the results of the stress test were produced a funding deficit outside of policy, then remediation would be required. What are we going to do about it? The Liability Management and Contingency Funding Plan was another document that outlined roles and responsibilities of executive members if we ever moved into an abnormal operating environment. such as the expectation or the possibility of a downgrade associated with the Q2 earnings release.
Okay, right. And I think, probably didn't use the same terms, but I think that was my understanding.
Okay.
So, and I take it practically what that, so now when you're running presumably at least three different scenario analyses or stress tests, but now post 2Q08, you're doing that presumably with different assumptions, including assumptions like what's going to happen if there's a one notch, two notch, three notch ratings downgrade.
Activated before earnings released.
Right, yeah. Right. Okay, of course.
That was in the May, end of May, beginning of June timeframe.
And do you recall what stage you went to at that point?
The next stage,
But you had been, I think Chris's question, but were you in the normal operating stage before Q2 208, or had you already gone to an elevated stage at that point?
And when he says before 2Q08, before you're anticipating impacts, before this May-June 08 timeframe that you were just mentioning, 2Q08 gets announced on July 22nd.
In policy terms, I think the answer is yes, but in practicing liquidity risk management funding, we had been long before that in a heightened state of readiness.
Okay. And why was that?
Market conditions, the succession of events that were happening unexpectedly,
so
and the speed at which they
fall of 07 time frame, when like in August of 07 when the credit markets froze up. I mean, when you say for a long time, can you put some more specificity on that? Credit rating agencies do the mass downgrade in July and October of 07, if that helps.
It's hard for me, upon reflection, to identify when that began, you know, when in my mind it began, but it was sometime in 07.
Okay. And so, but even when you're in a heightened state in sometime in 07, are the stress tests still being run under the normal operating environment or under the abnormal operating environment? If that's the right nomenclature that I'm hearing from you,
the stress tests are built off the baseline, which isn't going to change. That's just sources and uses of cash, and then you layer on the inputs, which are more severe. So, in my mind, they weren't really changing. That the policy construct was established and wasn't going to change. That was what kept us honest in terms of understanding what the risks were. So there was no subjectivity around that policy framework.
Okay. So is it really just sort of as time goes by and market dynamics change and company-specific dynamics change that, you know, the scenario analyses change?
So quarterly, when we do the stress tests, you'll have the results from the baseline funding.
Right.
And those will produce a funding surplus or deficit, funding need or surplus, and then you'll layer on the progressively harder, the progressively more severe assumptions. And those would change, for example, access to wholesale funding.
Right.
During the periodic market disruptions earlier, all the way back in 07, issuers on a non-name specific basis couldn't access funding. It was unreliable. Or if you did, it would be at a very punitive type of rate that you would want to issue into. So the combination of industry systemic and name specific pressures would change the inputs to the stress testing as we march through time.
Right. Okay. For the most part, I think I understand that. All right, so let's go back to the report. And I think we were up to the number big three, London issuance projection.
Uh, I think this was put on this page as an identification of the London branch's funding need. Established to be self-funding.
Oh, I see. Okay.
But we, in home office funding, wanted to know just what that was.
Okay.
That was your major foreign operation, essentially, and your largest foreign operation?
London was the largest offshore funding operation. There were others, smaller.
And again, just so I understand this correctly, so these numbers, for example, the $8.4 billion under August 31, means they don't have a funding need, right? They have a funding surplus.
In this case, I think that is their funding need.
This is what they're planning to issue?
Issue or roll over.
Okay.
But all these, Seb had say included in one, so these are all, 2, 3, and 4 are all included in one.
Thank you. Yeah. I didn't even see that, but yes.
Presumably.
Yep.
Okay. And then number 4, the Congress issuance projection, is what's that?
Congress was a I think Congress was an entity in Canada that issued its own commercial paper.
Oh, okay.
I don't know whether it was owned by the Bank of the Whole Co. I'm not sure.
Government issue pen. Okay, and then 5 is just the sum total of everything, right? Or is it? What is 5?
So it says corporate consolidated cumulative term issuance needed. So we'd have to do the math, but I think it's that total.
Okay. So it's the sum of 1 through 4, you think?
I think.
We'll have to go back and see.
This is all wholesale funding we're talking about here. Separate and apart from your basic retail deposit operation.
Embedded in the funding need would be the loan deposit forecast that came from forecasting.
Okay.
So a possible solution may be to go back and issue, try and raise the deposit forecast in order to load the funding need.
Okay. So it would be affected by that. This forecast would be affected by what you're, both your deposit side and your lending side, we're doing.
That's right.
Okay. I mean, I don't mean to harp on this, but it seems this is confusing because it says included in one, included in one, included in one, and then you go to the top. It says after expected holding company London Congress issuance include issues in 2, 3, and 4. So, but then I mean, the truth, you add up these numbers and you get the bottom line here.
Okay.
So it's contradictory. One says it's included and the other says it's not. But we need to clarify that for us.
So I think 2, 3, 4, and 5 pull out the funding that will be done elsewhere that, if it doesn't incur, would raise the funding need of that, would raise the $39 billion. So I think we had it identified to know where exposure was. Does that make sense now? So it's in this number. And then we pull it out to see what it is, because if it doesn't come to pass, it would raise the funding need.
So then you come down here to line 19, where it says final term issuance estimates A or B. So
okay, now we're back to the difference between the baseline funding, right, and what will be required if you're not passing the stress test. And the stress test is designed to contain the amount of short-term funding.
I get it. Well, let's push on, because I'm still confused, but maybe it'll become clear next week.
All right. This is incredibly easy to read. But now we're on page 4, which is titled Consolidated Liquidity Projection. So I'm certainly not going to ask you to read the numbers, but just generally describe to me what this report is telling us.
Yeah, I'm having trouble seeing everything, too. Generally, this would be the detail. From my recollection, this should be the detail, the breakout on the earlier page.
Roll through page 5, titled Additional Market Related Cash Flow.
I think this relates to, and I don't know the timing, where we started pulling out market-sensitive activities to figure out, to identify what they were and know the risk if they did or did not occur, or if they did not occur.
So I don't know if I understand what you're saying. So give me an example by maybe looking at one of these line items.
Line 4, VFCC, which is Variable Funding Capital Corp, the asset-backed commercial paper conduit with Wachovia enhancement.
Okay.
Looks like they're going to issue $100 million in commercial paper. Mm-hmm. And that wouldn't have gone in the baseline because VFCC was established to be self-funding.
Okay. And that would be the same for these other ones, too? Possibly having to go raise funds externally?
Heavily dependent on market conditions to occur. Mm-hmm. And because of periodic market disruptions, this is the effort to sort of identify what those contingencies were.
Mm-hmm. It's like when we go down to line 5 and we see money market and I don't know what the MTN
medium
is.
Medium-term notes
and CDOs, I take it. Mm-hmm. I mean, collateralized debt obligations, right?
I think so.
So does that mean that they're looking at the possibility of, in October of 08, of having to raise $548 million through those types of instruments? Like, I guess, raising rates on a money market account or something to acquire those types of deposits?
I recall that being cash out to bring those on balance sheet.
Okay. Because they were consolidated conduits at that point.
Yeah, I don't remember the specifics of this activity, but generally I think that was cash out associated with bringing those on the balance sheet because they couldn't be remarketed.
You couldn't fund them through the conduit anymore. The conduit couldn't issue its asset-backed commercial paper, probably.
Not necessarily the conduit, because this would be independent of VFCC, the asset-backed conduit,
okay.
But these would be, I think, notes that would be sold into the market that couldn't.
The market didn't want the medium-term notes anymore.
Yeah, and I don't remember if it was a market disruption systemic or name specific to Wachovia.
Okay. Let's move on. Page 6, titled Holding Company Only. Liquidity projection.
I recall that this should be the breakout, the detail behind the summary page.
And the summary page was, I think, page 2 that we were looking at in the beginning, right?
Page 3, line 2, the big line 2.
This page or this page?
Well, so maybe
the breakout to this.
This one, and I think this is layer. This page two is built from page three because it assumes that we will roll over federal home loan borrowings as they come due.
Right.
Whereas this assumes no automatic rollover. There's no debt issuances. Just how much do you need to issue? Mm-hmm. This assumes that you're rolling over the federal home loan borrowings that are maturing.
Okay.
So it's like a, yeah, it's a further build out of the page three.
Right. And when we're looking at page six, and it says Wachovia Corp holding company only liquidity projection, is page six the detail for page three, big two?
The cumulative numbers are the same.
Yeah, it looks like the
okay.
cumulative numbers are the same.
Okay. So then, page 7.
Page 7 would be an exhibit identifying how much overnight borrowed funds the company was accessing.
Okay, right, because this ends at July of 08. So this is actually what has occurred.
And so is it fair to say in February you actually had to exceed your policy limit at that point, or right around February, maybe it's March?
Let's see.
Where it got to 22.382 or something like that.
This is quarterly, so it's not going to be on that.
I was looking at the graph that... Yeah, it is 22.382 at 331. That's right.
I'm not sure, to be honest. I don't remember I don't remember how policy worked with respect to what's included in that overnight number.
Oh, okay.
Is it everything everywhere globally, or is
just
it
the Fed funds?
Just the Fed funds desk, right? I don't remember.
One question that I have is. Were you getting feedback from your staff as to what was happening between, you know, obviously March and June, where your overnight funds borrowed plummeted? Were you hearing that banks were becoming more and more reluctant to lend to you, or was it that you didn't need the money? I mean, what's happening during that period where the borrowings are going down so much?
When you say from your Fed staff?
I meant from your Treasury staff, I should have said, or whoever, you know, really handles the Fed funds desk.
I can't conclude that based on this information because...
You don't remember people saying that we can't get people to loan Fed funds to us? I mean, was there any feedback like that coming that banks were becoming very reluctant to make those kinds of overnight loans?
Standard operating procedure would be to continuously collect feedback from the sales force on the market's reception to a Wachovia name. And... where you draw the beginning of that being systemic versus name specific is hard to pick, but it's hard to choose when that began. But the market disruption affected everybody at times, and those that had more name specific pressure would tend to be the first in queue to be affected. So they couldn't access debt at all, or they could, but it wider spreads than its peers. That was the cycle of all debt issuers that relied on wholesale funding from sometime in 2007 until fall of 08.
Just a couple data points that happened right about this time. One is that NEMAC fails and is not bailed out. And, in fact, the uninsured deposits aren't protected. On the other hand, Bear Stearns is bailed out. Do you remember whether people were telling you NEMAC is hurting us, you know, Bear Stearns workout is not helping as much as we thought? I mean, remember people talking about those kinds of events or not?
What I recall is everybody at Wachovia everybody, that's all for inclusive. All participants in the market were very concerned about market conditions because they were moving swiftly. It was an unpredictable environment, and IndyMac and Bear Stearns just raised the level of uncertainty. So everybody was kind of retreating to their bunkers and just waiting for what's next.
And again, you may not have heard this, but you remember people saying, oh, well, Bear Stearns got bailed out. That means we're okay. You know, they may have let IndyMac go. They're a $30 billion institution, but they're not going to let someone like us get in deep trouble because, you know, we're an $800 billion institution.
I don't remember anything like that about Wachovia at this time.
Let me ask you this. You mentioned there were minutes for these meetings. I mean, these are pretty substantial declines after the first quarter of 08. Do you think that this is the type of issue that would have been discussed and reflected in the minutes for not only July of 08, but, you know, April, May, June, as the numbers continue to go down? I would suspect to see something in the minutes saying, you know, overnight funds have gone from $22.4 billion to $5.5 billion over the last few months, and here's why we think it's happening.
I don't know that would have been in there. We'd have to check the minutes. I observed there's, you know, even way back there were, you know, high and low fluctuations.
Sure. Arts asked you what your recollection is. I mean, do you recall whether there was a deliberate decision at Wachovia to reduce this funding source? Or was this more, was it Wachovia's choice or the market's choice?
We were clearly moving away, if we could, from an overnight funding alliance and wholesale funding alliance. Mm-hmm. That was just normal, a case of action given very uncertain market conditions.
Mm-hmm.
My recollection is that other participants were doing the same.
Okay. There was, and again, I know it's a little before this, well, maybe not since the July 31 year, probably this was a meeting sometime in August, obviously, but that same OCC exam report said that you guys had activated a contingency funding plan. This OCC letter was August 4th, 2008, and that included new retail and wholesale deposit promotions and trying to reduce assets. Does that jog any memory bells in terms of actions the bank was taking in the post 2Q or 2Q08 and subsequent time frame?
My recollection is that May June time frame, we identified in the liability management contingency funding plan that we needed to get ready and get prepared.
And was that May, June 08 get prepared decision made because by that point the bank knew that when we announced 2Q8 earnings they're not going to be good, and there was concern about, you know, what was going to happen to the company short term and wholesale funding sources?
It was concern about that and the market conditions associated with the movement from kind of systemic stress to name-specific stress.
Right, okay.
Were you aware that the bank was going to write down such a huge amount in July?
I was not a part of the forecasting or P&L team.
Mm-hmm.
I had general information that earnings weren't going to be very good.
Right, but my experience has been nobody really knows until the last few days. I mean, do you know months in advance, or I mean, obviously,
I don't hear anything until towards the end of the month.
Hmm.
We can go to about an hour. Why don't we take a
sure
5-minute rest of the day?
So are we back on?
Back on.
Okay, thanks. So, looking to page 8 now of the July 31, 2008 monthly liquidity report, if you could just describe that for us, please.
This looks like another regular piece to the monthly liquidity package, which would pull out wholesale funding line items.
And that would be the top part of the report, right, that finishes with the total secured and unsecured borrowings outstanding line?
That's correct.
And then after that, we get the core deposit numbers. Let me just ask you, for example, when we look at this at July of 08 and we see the wholesale funding and the deposits and it's 83%, is there any other funding sources or is that just all like the deferred taxes and accounts payable and all that kind of stuff on the liability side of the balance sheet? Or are there other funding sources that aren't included here?
I'm not sure. This would have been everything we looked at and thought was within our purview.
Okay. Okay. So then when we get down to the short, I think it's a short liquid asset, this section, purpose. I mean, I know what short liquid assets are, but what's the purpose of having this in here?
Tracking access to cash from short-term assets. So this would, in effect, roll back in short order. This is a source of cash. It's
right. So if you wanted to, you could reduce your $269.7 billion, billion dollars of wholesale funding to $250 by selling the short-term assets, the short-term liquid assets.
Yeah, that I think that looks
right.
That's
what the difference is, right. And then it looks like you're also taking, then we go down to the next line, is total unsecured borrowings, but I guess just net of, I assume that's federal funds sold and euro placements. So on that, we're just taking this line item, right? Not the...
It looks to me like it's right. That number, total unsecured, less Fed funds sold, that number,
right.
Less your placements, that number.
And what's why, I mean, I got the liquid asset one. I don't know if I get that one. Why do we do that?
I think we would track that because it's net. It's your net unsecured reliance on wholesale funds.
Okay. Okay. And then the next section of the report are identified contingent liabilities. So I assume these are like funding commitments for loan commitments that you may have made to fund loans and things like that. Is that what you're talking about? And additional potential liquidity needs.
Yeah, it looks like this would be off-balance sheet contingent liabilities that carry some sort of obligation on the part of Wachovia to redeem or repurchase if they can't be sold or remarketed.
Okay. So, for example, when we look at the first line item, Wachovia Conduit, VFCC, what is that?
VFCC is Variable Funding Capital Corp, the asset-backed commercial paper conduit, mm-hmm. and that would be the total outstandings enhanced by Wachovia.
Either through a liquidity put or something like that. Yeah.
Okay.
And you had to take this back on, right?
I don't remember. Some of these we did, some of these we didn't. I don't remember the order.
It looks like Blue Ridge you must have taken back on, and Centric you must have taken back on, because they disappear from the contingent liability.
But way back when.
Yeah, long ago, right.
I recall those being consolidated into the FCC.
Oh, that makes sense.
Yeah, the numbers make sense.
Like, yeah. If you add the two numbers together in 2005.
Okay. And presumably, these numbers will come off subsequent reports if you guys had to take them back in, right? If we see a September report without a number on the VFCC line, then we know that you took that in.
And then it becomes part of your funding.
Right, it'll show somewhere else, and so appears somewhere, I guess.
Could I ask you just a general question on this particular chart 8? If I'm looking from, let's say, December 2007 to July 2008, the trend lines I'm seeing are that you're...
Art, are you on, what page are you on?
I'm on page 8, the same one
okay.
you're looking at.
Okay.
So your total secured and unsecured borrowings are going up by about 70 billion, looks like. Your core deposits are essentially staying the same. They're down by about 10 billion, but you know, not materially different. And then your secured and unsecured, well, I guess where it says total secured and unsecured borrowings down below, is that sort of a subpart? Because that's also going up by about 70. Is that the same 70 billion I see up above here? Where it goes from 199 to 269?
Okay, let's do that again.
If you go about halfway down the page, okay. It says total secured and unsecured borrowings outstanding. And then you come across and you see where December 2007 it says 199, 228. And then it moves up to 269,779.
Okay.
And then looking at core deposits, they don't change much. They go down by about 10 billion.
Okay.
Now, if we drop down, where it says total secured and unsecured borrowed funds, and that'll look. Net of liquid assets, is that essentially a subpart of the 199 number? The 182 in December 2007 is a subset of 199 up above, or is that something different? Because it looks like it's total secured and unsecured borrowings, but you've taken something out.
Right.
Taken liquid assets out, I guess. Is that right?
Yeah.
So if you look at just the two-line numbers then, is it fair to say that what's happening during this period is that you've increased your reliance on wholesale liabilities by about 70 billion, and your core deposits have stayed about the same. They've gone down a little bit by 10 billion. I mean, is that kind of consistent with what you remember that you were having to increase your reliance on wholesale liabilities during this period by a fairly substantial amount?
Yeah, I don't remember what was going on with the balance sheet at large because
right.
to the extent the balance sheet's growing.
On the funding side, yeah.
On the funding side, it looks like, as you described, the percentage of assets funded by wholesale borrowings are going up as the balance sheet is growing.
And, the question I had on this, too, was when I first looked at this, I said, oh, they must be growing because the absolute numbers are going up, but you're not. And so then I looked at the percentages, and you see when you go from December of 07, you know, you're looking at 76%. This represents, and we're up to 83% by July. And that's why I'd asked you before,
mm-hmm.
Here if the 17% is just deferred taxes and accounts payable and all that. But do you remember, I guess, is there other, long-term funding that's not reflected in this chart that would explain these numbers changing? Is it also something we don't see here, long-term funding going into short-term funding?
Equity would be a component.
Okay. You raised a lot of money in the first or second, first quarter of 08, right? Wasn't there a big, a lot of money, a big equity offering in some preferred shares?
I recall April of 08 was the capital raise.
Right.
I think it was like $8 billion.
So that's long-term capital?
Yeah. But it would indicate that maybe what we could call your borrowed funding, totally, in aggregate, has gone from 76 to 83, I guess, that these two lines, two numbers together. This would not include, obviously, your long-term debt. If you had subordinated debt outstanding, that would not be included in these numbers, right? Or what would it be?
Looks like HC holding company medium term notes.
But not if you have 5-year subordinated debt, for example.
I don't remember if.
If long term liabilities are included here, right?
I don't remember. I think they are, but I don't remember.
Okay. But sorry, equity is not, right? Right.
Okay. Let's move on to.
One question here.
Sure.
I'm sort of going backwards and forwards. In April 2008 is the first time we see discount window borrowings. and that goes to 8.5 billion to 10 billion. So those are, that's where you are borrowing money from the government, right?
That is accessing the term auction facility from the Federal
Reserve. TALF or whatever.
Right.
TALF.
Yeah. But you're saying two different things. Term auction facility or TALF is a different one?
Right. TALF is different.
Yeah, TALF.
Yeah, okay. Were you required to do that, or was that that one, or this was on your own volition?
That was our decision.
Okay.
And that was... How long was that? Was that 90-day money, or was that, I can't remember how long the returns were for that. Probably something like 90 days? Or
it varied. I think there was longer and shorter term options that you had to bid for to win.
Right.
Okay. Why did you do that?
It was a substitute for wholesale funding. When wholesale funding was inaccessible.
Hmm. And what is the same reason for the spike in Federal Home Loan Bank borrowings?
That's right. Federal Home Loan Bank borrowings were a source of accessible collateralized borrowings when the wholesale funding markets were disrupted. Mm-hmm.
That was right after Bear Stearns. So $63 billion, that's a lot.
I don't remember the time of Bear Stearns, but...
It was March of 08.
March of 08, okay. March 16th. Okay. Yeah. So there must have been... You see how when you know, April is... You know, you have that $61, $62 billion of the TAF and the Federal Home Loan Bank borrowings. And when you go down to the total secured and unsecured borrowings outstanding, you've not surprisingly gone from 205 to 268. And that gets back to my question of what are we not seeing here that's being replaced? So am I going to see somewhere... a $62 billion decline in subordinated debt or in something else? Or
I don't know. That's a good question.
Doesn't
it
jog any memory bells about what happened? Okay.
Yeah, the problem is we don't have the assets to compare against this. Yeah, the asset numbers were changing, but I don't...
Oh, yeah, we do. They're at the very top.
Oh, okay. Okay. The total assets. So, yeah, all right. So those are not changing.
Right. Because I originally thought it was growth, but
right.
It wasn't.
Right. Those are not changing. Okay.
So let's move to page. Sorry, I'm going the wrong way. Page 9, which are your Wachovia's wholesale liability rates, which I think we understand this. This is just the time series on the LIBOR spreads for Wachovia, right? Mm.
Yeah, this looks like a chart in the data associated with what's your cost of funds.
Right.
What's your credit spreads. Mm-hmm.
And do you recall this? I mean, you see it fairly easier to see in the top chart since the other one's a much longer time series. But there's a pretty noticeable spike when you get to... Was that something that was driven, or at least was coincidental, with the July 22nd earnings release, or maybe even a little before, if there was any leakage involved?
I would say it was more the convergence of systemic risk, which was showing up in spreads for all issuers.
Mm-hmm.
But am I correct?
Let's finish. Yes.
Okay.
he's enough.
As well as name-specific cost of funds increases, spread risk. So it's hard for me to separate which component was which, but that's what was going on.
Okay. Go ahead, Art.
LIBOR is an average of, about 14 big banks that quote in London. So it's an average of those 14 participating banks. So to the extent you're spreading over LIBOR, isn't there more of a name-specific component to that? Because you're moving up against an average of 14 or so of your peers?
The definition of LIBOR is set by a certain number of banks, and so that becomes the base by which everybody issues. So right, it's right. really the credit spread on top of LIBOR that matters.
Right. And but my point would be that I understand LIBOR is moving up generally against any risk-free rate like Treasuries, obviously. But to the extent that you're moving up against LIBOR, doesn't that indicate more of a name-specific problem as opposed to a systemic problem? Or am I missing something?
I think you'd have to dissect the difference between absolute, which is Wachovia, and relative, which is everybody else. I recall that everybody else's spreads to LIBOR were widening, and that was because of the uncertainty in the market. So I would characterize that more as systemic. Everybody, LIBOR is doing what it's doing, and the spreads were gapping, were increasing for Wachovia and other participants.
Was Wachovia a LIBOR bank? I don't think so. But do you remember whether it was a participating bank in LIBOR?
I don't think Wachovia was a contributing LIBOR bank.
Okay, so let's move to page 10, which appears to be just a time series on the level of wholesale liabilities and the maturities of your wholesale liabilities. My first question before you tell me if I'm right or not, when we're talking wholesale liabilities, when we were looking back at page 3, I think it was, or not page 3, just the one page, is wholesale liabilities the secured and unsecured borrowing line on page 8? Is that what we're talking about on page here?
I think it'd be components of that in this. I don't know if it's every. I don't know if it's that very same 269 billion.
Okay.
But components of it.
Okay. All right. So, is my understanding correct that that's what page 10 is simply showing us the amount and maturity.
Yeah, big graph showing the as the bank growing, the absolute number of wholesale liabilities increasing, plotted against the weighted average maturity of that debt profile.
Okay, and what's OBS?
Off balance sheet.
It's off balance sheet.
It's a guess.
Yeah, that would be my guess.
Okay. And then again, at least well, the time series is sort of late, but it looks like even as we're in 08, and this is consistent, I think, what we've seen otherwise, that wholesale liabilities are going up not because the bank is growing, but just because the composition of the liabilities are changing into becoming comprised more of wholesale. Does that sound right for that second half of 2008 time frame, maybe even the first, starting with the beginning of the second quarter of 08?
It's still, you raised the point, and I have a question, and it's a question I don't have an answer to, is what was happening to cause that to occur? I don't remember.
Okay.
Because, as you said, the balance sheet was static according to what we saw earlier.
Sure. And do you recall generally that, in terms of your wholesale funds, folks wanted shorter maturities in 2008?
I don't think that was intentional. I think that was a result of not being able to access the wholesale funding markets in long-term debt. So you're forced to rely on short-term maturities, and that which you have has a shorter life to it. So I think that was unintentional.
Okay, but this... All right, so when we're talking about wholesale liabilities, is that inclusive of long-term debt?
Yeah. I don't know if what we saw on that earlier page that you pointed out is the same number that's
right.
used in there. I don't know that.
No, and I understand that, but I mean, if we're, I could understand your answer is if this does include long-term debt.
Yep.
But if it doesn't, then, you know, long-term debt's not in here yet. We're still seeing the maturities going down.
Right. My recollection is total wholesale liabilities would include long-term debt.
Okay. That's your recollection. You don't know it for sure.
That's correct.
Let's move to 11, which is consolidated liquidity projection, net portfolio size, and funding changes. Tell me how, explain this page to me.
The title tells me this would be what is happening to our investment portfolio.
Mm-hmm. That's just copies for us.
Okay, okay. If it's increasing, it's a use of cash, unless it's self-funded, you know, in the mm-hmm. repo market or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
And if it's decreasing, it would be a source of cash. So when I see expected portfolio runoff, I would think that would be cash in from the investment portfolio, or maturities of the investment portfolio.
Okay. So these are assets, securities, MBS, and CMOs that are going to run off and provide cash to Wachovia.
Yeah, if there are no repurchases or anything like that.
Right, that's the projection.
Yes.
Yeah, that makes sense. Okay. All right. So we're going to do, so Wachovia Corporation Consolidated Liquidity Projection CIB activity. I assume this is a similar thing.
CIB standing for Corporate Investment Bank. So to the extent there were any market-related activities taking place that we'd want to know cash in or cash out on.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So let me get to page 13. Wachovia average forecasted core deposit cash and loan balance with projected growth. Various tranches of the table. So if you just walk us through that real quick, just so we know that we're interpreting it correctly.
Title-wise, this should be the inputs from the forecasting team that would represent cash in or out associated with the forecast of changes in loans and deposits.
Okay. So, for example, the forecasting team is projecting that core deposits are gonna increase over time until at least 12/31/09.
Right.
When it goes down slightly. Okay.
Does the forecasting team work for you?
No.
Okay.
And is that this for everything here? These are inputs provided by the forecasting team that go into you guys managing liquidity.
I think that's right.
Okay. And then moving on to page 14, the funding forecast. Now, this is Wachovia Bank funding forecast, and then we've got Wachovia Corporation funding forecast. So from looking at the numbers, if you know, is this consolidated, this being the Wachovia Corporation, and include the bank, or are these separate?
Just going by the titles, it looks like they're separate.
Yeah, that's what I thought too.
Mm-hmm.
So just walk me through it, make me sure I'm interpreting it correctly, and I think I am, but again, if you could just quickly summarize the page.
All right, so this would be your starting place, and these would represent cash outflows, and then sources, and then a ending overnight position that you'd have to address somehow. Now, this to me looks like a surplus moving towards funding needs as you go forward in time.
Okay. Just want to do that. That's the same thing for the others. Okay. And then we get... So presumably when I asked you about agendas, I should have looked closer at this. Presumably the meeting where you guys got the July 31, 2008 monthly liquidity report was a meeting on August 28, 2008. Is that generally how it worked?
Yeah, looks like it was, you know, the processing time. We met a month later to review that data.
Okay. And then moving on to page... the Bates range, 2102. There's some key points here about the FHLB borrowings. It stated here that the primary collateral was the pick-a-pay portfolio, and that the portfolio and that the advances are also supported by $14 to $18 billion in non-agency securities that were at risk of downgrade that would provide additional pricing pressure and eventual loss of collateral. Generally, in this time frame, I guess now we're talking as of August 26 as opposed to July 31, since that's 2 days before the meeting. In this time frame, was there an issue with the Federal Home Loan Banks saying, gee, guys, we're not so comfortable with the pick-a-pay collateral, and we're not so comfortable with other securities because we're concerned about pricing and valuations?
I recall that the Federal Home Loan Banks were concerned. They were regularly concerned. There was a collateral pricing and haircut that was it was updated frequently. So to the extent that pricing on the pledged securities came in lower or they adjusted haircuts, then the advance rate would be lower. So if the combination of lower pricing and higher haircuts meant that you need to provide more collateral, then you need to get it to them, because if they're ever deemed, if they ever deem themselves to be uncollateralized, then they can take action.
So was there ever an issue at Wachovia about providing additional collateral, or did Wachovia simply say, we're not going to give you more collateral, we'll just pay the higher price, or something else?
There was a collateral management team that managed that relationship with the home loan, and that's all they did is make sure that we had enough collateral pledged and against borrowings and pledged for additional borrowings so that we could be ready to source them as a funding source.
Okay. Well, given that, though, I mean, over time, were the rates going up because of concerns about the value of the collateral, or did that just mean give us more collateral to keep the rate where it is?
It was more a collateral issue, not a rate issue. So as long as they were, rates for the home loan were generally static, the cost of borrowings, it was more keeping enough collateral there so that they didn't have remedies under their contract.
Were there issues in terms of providing that collateral? For example, I mean, of course, your repos are collateralized, and did Wachovia ever have an issue with providing that collateral? Did they have to, for example, lower their bank boarded, their Federal Home Loan Bank advances because they didn't have additional collateral that the Federal Home Loan Banks wanted?
I recall while we were accessing Federal Home borrowings, the combination of pricing going down and haircuts changing, requiring more collateral to be available and delivered. Yes, that was occurring during this period of time.
And did they start taking, I mean, obviously at this point it looks like you were using mainly option ARMs as collateral, the pick-a-pay mortgages. Did they start taking you're better collateral. In other words, you're better, either you're better mortgages than you had them, or, you know, perhaps you're better investment securities. I don't know if that would be coming within your purview, that people would say, well, gee, I've got to take away part of your investment portfolio, which is kind of part of your liquidity management, because we've got to move it over here to collateralize the advances.
The collateral team would get the reports from FHLB, and there were three of them, Atlanta, San Francisco, and Dallas. San Francisco tended to get the option pick-a-pays, and Dallas and Atlanta got either mortgages or securities, MBS.
Yeah.
And so the collateral team would get the report, and it would be after they priced it and haircut it, and then there'd be enough collateral or a collateral need, and then they would take action to meet that need, or if they got advice from the funding desk, to put more on deposit there so that we could borrow against.
And thank you for that. But my question is, in addition to having to post additional collateral because of the haircut requirements changing, did there ever come a time at Wachovia where it's like, we don't have more, so we're going to have to reduce our, or we don't want to post more, and our decision is instead we're going to reduce our Federal Home Loan Bank advances?
We worked hard to keep the home loans very satisfied because they represented a source of liquidity when everything else was unavailable. So if pricing, which drove the advance rate lower, more so than haircuts, if those converge, pricing and haircut converge to require a greater collateral need, then our collateral team would find a way to meet that need. So we were in a constant maintenance mode to make sure that the home loans had all the security they need, so we could continue to access borrowings.
And do you recall whether the Federal Home Loan Bank said this collateral's doesn't qualify anymore? There's a notation on this page that talks about the interagency guidance, and that, you know, if the FHLB takes action, you guys could lose $9 billion in pledgeable collateral. Presumably that meant non-traditional mortgages or subprime mortgages or something like that.
But there was guidance basically that if you didn't underwrite to the fully amortized rate, that they might not take it anymore.
Right. Did that become an issue, do you know? I know you're not the collateral guy.
We had regular contact with all three FHLBs on the issue of collateral management, whether it be interagency guidance or optional ARM pricing. That was a regular type of activity during this period of time.
I understand that. But did they ever say, you know, well, this stuff doesn't count anymore, there's $9 billion gone that you need to replace now, or, you know, anything like that, where they said, we don't want the pick a pay, we don't want the stuff that you're underwriting to teaser rates or whatever it may be, and you got to come up with better stuff?
I recall, for example, Dallas saying there is the potential that if this interagency guidance is interpreted in such a way that some of your collateral will become ineligible.
Do you recall it ever happening?
I don't recall it happening.
Okay.
But I remember discussions about the potential that it could.
Okay.
And just to be clear, it was happening on the pricing front. As the pricing services the home loans used had a lower value on pledged loans or securities.
If you turn to the next page.
Just one question before we go there. Discuss with you, Chris.
Go ahead.
Do you want to ask a little bit about Project Stanley? I mean, there's repeated references to Project Stanley here.
Sure, and we've seen it in other documents, right. In addition to another project.
That's something you were involved with, and could you give us sort of the basic parameters of what Project Stanley was and what you were trying to do with it?
I was from time to time, participant in Project Stanley, but that I didn't run that. That was the effort to, you know, deleverage and exit non-core businesses. Preserve capital.
Sign off assets, assets that you felt weren't part of the core business of the institute, the organization?
I think that was the intent of Stanley, Project Stanley.
And were they also deciding that they were, you know, in a sense, not originating more of the pick-and-pay mortgages? Is that?
I don't know about that.
Okay.
Do you remember when that was instituted?
When what was it?
Project Stanley.
No, I don't. It was on or about the time Alvin came into existence, I think.
And what is Alvin? That was the other name I couldn't remember.
Alvin was the project name given to that end of May, beginning June activation of the liability management and contingency funding plan.
Okay. That's the going to the other stage and the higher state of concern about rating downgrades and all that.
Yes.
I know
yes.
I butchered that, but so and you think Project Stanley also in the May, June 2008 time frame there's Project Stanley and Project Alvin get instituted. You know, one, we need to be more vigilant here and be more careful about the liquidity needs, and two, we're going to start shrinking the balance sheet.
Yeah, they were about the same time.
Okay.
The turn I was going to is the next page there refers to the same topic. Okay, it's another page. I don't have a number. Page number 2105. And that's this borrowing.
2105? Because the next page
has got something different.
Because the next page is 2103.
We don't have this chart here also.
Well, no, I mean, if you're on 2105, that's fine, but the next page is not 2105.
All right.
So let's go in order. So on 2103, FHLB excess collateral projection, this appears to just be more of what we were just talking about from the previous page, yes?
This looks like the quantitative demonstration of collateral values.
Okay, we'll look at that. Okay, Bruce, I mean...
This was talking about I think the top line is required collateral. And so something happened in March 08 requiring more collateral based on your borrowings. I think that's what that says. You know, this addresses the topic we were just talking about where all of a sudden it seems like they're requiring more collateral. That's this... The point you hear about the, you know, requiring more collateral.
I would agree that gap looks like the collateral needs were increasing against a relatively static borrowing.
So then, unfortunately, we only have June 08 here. Then what happens in the next 3 months? Do you remember?
I don't know.
Well, more importantly, did you recall why? Maybe not necessarily more importantly. In addition, do you recall why the spreads increased in terms of the difference between the borrowing and the amount of collateral required?
I recall it being that same dynamic of pricing and haircuts.
You're writing down the value of the pick-a-pay mortgages and the mortgage-backed securities that you've pledged already, essentially.
Yeah, not any one thing, but all prices of whole loans and securities were going lower. Mm-hmm. And haircuts could have been increasing, so you got to pledge more collateral to...
Cover the same borrowings.
That's it.
Okay. All right, let me get to Federal Home Loan Bank borrowing recommendations. There's some cut off, but most efficient borrowing is in Atlanta to the extent possible. Now maturities in Dallas and San Francisco cut off and something in Atlanta. But, I mean, I think it's – you don't need to explain to me what this is because I see you're looking at the three different Federal Home Loan Banks and listing pros and cons. And I take it this is just a normal course of business thing. Which of the three banks do we want to have our relationship with?
Optimization. Mm-hmm. What's the order in which we can deliver collateral and access borrowings?
Mm-hmm. And was there a preferred bank? I think I haven't looked at this morning, but my recollection was I think Dallas is like the one you had the long relationship with.
I recall that it moved around depending on willingness and ability to lend and collateral requirements. Those have been the drivers, and those were kind of always changing.
Okay. Okay. Again, the next page appears to just be a listing of what we've been talking about. The amount of borrowings, the pricing, the haircuts, et cetera.
Yeah, not looking at the numbers, this should be greater detail on what's pledged, the price of the haircut, and the advance rate. Mm-hmm.
So just make sure we're understanding. If we're looking at, let's just look at FHLBSS since it's the first one, does this mean that there's $62.7 billion of advances from the Federal Home Loan Bank of San Francisco?
I think that's...
Is that the collateral pledge?
That's the collateral pledge.
Okay. And then they haircut
price
it?
They price
okay.
it.
Okay.
And then they haircut it.
Okay. So does that mean that that's what you could borrow against that amount of collateral?
39.7.
Against 63? Yeah. Is that what that means?
I think that's what it means.
Okay.
CPV is current present value?
Maybe current par value?
For collateral pledge value? I don't know.
Yeah. If it was present value, then haircuts necessarily wouldn't make sense if it was supposedly a fair value number. But
or maybe it could be collateral par value. That's mm-hmm. true. That's the face value of the collateral.
That would make more sense if we're talking about haircuts and pricing.
Okay.
See, we don't need you here. We can just talk amongst ourselves and figure it out.
is
that your understanding? I guess we should ask the question instead of talking amongst ourselves.
That will be my understanding, that it's the value of the collateral pledged before pricing and haircut.
Right, but when you say value, you mean like par value, like book par value, not a mark-to-market fair value.
Correct.
These are just continuations of the same thing. Okay, well, that took longer than I had hoped. Let me ask you some questions just generally that won't require us to sit around and go through documents. But what I'd like you to do is just, from the best of your recollection, just sort of take me through 08, you know, and in particular, or take me through the time frame where, you know, liquidity started to become an issue. You know, we've seen some things in this report since it goes back earlier in terms of, you know, the changing in the composition of the liabilities, the changing in collateral requirements for Federal Home Loan Bank advances, and things like that. And, of course, we know from other documents that, you know, once you get into September, things really, once you get into your 2Q8 earnings release after that, there's issues. You've talked about the May-June 2008 time frame. The earnings release comes out. There's some issues. And when you get into September, particularly after WAMU goes down, of course, there's huge issues. But I'd like you, to the extent, can you sort of walk me through the timing of what's going on generally with liquidity management and what the concerns and the issues are for whatever time frame you should go back to. I don't know if that means summer of 07 or further back, or maybe it's, you know, after that. But can you just sort of give us a flavor of what was going on in the company liquidity wise?
Okay, that's a lot.
Yes.
the 2000 and fall 2007 environment, I recall being characterized by unreliable markets, concern, you know, dating earlier from, you know, subprime was in the newspaper, and some of the originate to distribute models were having trouble, and the Bear Stearns funds, all that was making headlines. So I would characterize the fall of the 07 environment as liquidity conditions in general were very, very unreliable. Markets were closed from time to time, I recall participants being very interested in what the headlines would reveal the next day. And that continued throughout the time period we're talking about.
Now, let me ask you, in this August of fall of 07 time frame, are funding sources, you said some markets were closed. Are they closed or just prices really high? Or both?
Both. Okay. Sometimes pricings were so wide that you wouldn't want to issue into that because that would be a sign of weakness.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes they were just closed because something happened. Somebody read something that shocked the markets.
Okay, so go, I'm sorry to interrupt. Go ahead and continue.
So just kind of moving through that timeline, then you had first quarter 08. I recall earnings from all institutions being a concern to market participants. I recall the capital raise of Wachovia that we talked about in April of 08. And I recall a series of events From then,
did you feel the capital raise was expensive? I mean, you raised a lot of money in the face of terrible market.
Well,
you raised a lot of capital at a terrible time. So that, did you feel that was very expensive?
Expensive from my view in terms of, you know, dilution, but access was probably more important than price.
Right, but you would have a sense of price earnings, or that people would make some estimates of what the price should be. Was that at the high range, or the low range, or the high range, or did, I mean?
I don't know about that. Yeah, I don't know about that.
Sorry, okay, go on.
Okay. So, a series of events after the capital raise that were problematic and more name-specific to Wachovia. So, I recall a movement from kind of systemic risk to more Wachovia-specific risk during the post-capital raise time until the Q2 earnings release.
And what were some of those Wachovia-specific events that you remember as being, you know, significant to what market participants might have thought?
I recall headlines associated with the telemarketing problems and we had departure of the CEO and sort of that interim gap. And I don't remember, I remember more Wachovia-specific headlines, yeah. But I can't identify those now, but it feels like there are more.
And maybe more focus on the pay option ARM problems. Is that already arising in the first quarter that people were focusing on, that you were heavily exposed to those?
I recall participants being more and more concerned about, you know, how, what is subprime, how is it defined, what does it include?
Because pick and pay loans weren't considered subprime, right?
They were all A's, I guess, mainly.
That's beyond me. It's a matter of opinion, I think.
But more importantly, and that's why I drafted the paper I drafted, I am almost positive that certainly the performance of the payment option ARM portfolio that came from Wachovia, came from Golden West, had definitely shown pretty substantial signs of deterioration. I mean, delinquencies were up on that portfolio, and I think loan loss provisions were up in that portfolio before the 2Q08 earnings release. Does that simply jog any memory bells in terms of that decline in asset quality, at least in that portfolio, which was a $120 billion portfolio, not chump change in terms of the total size of the bank, as being some of these Wachovia-specific issues that market participants were concerned about?
I recall a similar concern on the part of investors about the performance of the of that portfolio.
Okay. So continue, take us through, I guess now we're getting up to the 2Q08 earnings release.
So that in the May-June time frame, when the accumulation of all these name-specific Wachovia events and the potential for a credit downgrade after Q2 earnings release sets up the activation of Project Alvin.
And Stanley.
And Stanley. I don't remember the order, but...
August 08?
No,
earlier.
May, June.
May, June.
But the earnings don't come out until August.
But if I heard you correctly, you're saying that you knew earnings weren't going to be good, so leading up to that in May and June, you institute Project Alvin and Stanley, and you talk about, you know, instead of doing the normal operating environment, you're getting into the next more stressed operating environment in terms of doing your assumptions for liquidity planning, right?
It was the potential for downgrade with the July 22nd earnings release, but it was also that sequence of events which had turned more attention to Wachovia and the name-specific risk. And as you described, there was concern about the performance of that portfolio.
Now, in this time frame, before, as you're instituting Project Alvin and Stanley and doing the other things,
Are any of the companies' counterparties pulling their money out?
I recall a reducing ability over time, a steadily reducing ability to access the wholesale funding markets, first kind of long term, then progressively shorter term extensions of credit.
Do you recall when Mr. Steele comes in as CEO and whether did he activate some of these new plans like Alvin and Stanley that we're talking about, or had those steps been taken even before he came on board?
It was about the same time.
If it helps, he was announced as coming on board on July 9th.
Okay.
Which sounds a little after, and a whopping week and a half before the July 22nd $8.9 billion net loss earnings release.
A lot of it is in process already, yeah.
Okay, so you said there was a steadily declining ability to access the wholesale funding markets first long-term and then short-term. When does that steadily declining ability start?
Hard to say where it moves from systemic, which is everybody is encountering the same sort of market disruption, to be name-specific. If you ask me to sort of circle a general period of time when that starts occurring, it's after the succession of events we're talking about from the whatever I identified.
Fall 7, DSAM, hedge funds, and all that stuff.
No, I'm later than that.
Okay.
After.
Are you in 08?
I'm in the telemarketing.
After Kenneth Thompson stuff is ousted.
That's the time frame I'm talking about.
Okay, so we're talking in the months leading up to the 2Q08 earnings release in July. Okay, and is that also when you're seeing it, or when you believe it's more of a name-specific issue as opposed to just a systemic industry issue?
It's becoming more apparent and more identifiable that it's now two things, systemic, which did not abate, but now it's name-specific as well.
And does that mean, by implication, that sort of prior to this maybe April-May 2008 time frame, that the belief anyway was any steadily declining ability to access wholesale funding markets is not because of Wachovia, but because of just the disruption in the markets in general?
It's hard for me to mark the inflection point when that occurred. Mm-hmm. In my mind, from my recollection, it's somewhere in that, April, May time frame.
Okay.
Or maybe to characterize it being more abrupt and more severe than it had been prior to.
And whenever that point may be, that point where name-specific Wachovia issues are becoming more of a factor, at that time, do you see any funding counterparties yanking their money out?
I don't see that type of behavior. I see and hear from the Salesforce reporting back that lines are being reduced, term maturities being decreased. More that type of behavior.
Do you have any discussions with any funding counterparties in your position? Did you ever talk to folks about, are you going to roll, are you not going to roll?
The mechanism for that really came off the syndicate desk, mm-hmm. At Wachovia, who were talking to other borrowers and issuers.
Okay. Did you talk to those folks?
We had regular back and forth with the syndicate desk about state of markets, who's doing what, what's the feedback you're getting from our investors?
So when you're in this post-April, May, June time frame and going forward and things are more name-specific and you're talking to the sales, and you say you're talking to the sales force, is that the same thing as the syndicate desk?
Yes, okay. I use them interchange.
That's what I thought. Are they saying who is reducing lines and pulling money out?
They are identifying some counterparties, and I think we would listen, and at some point in time we'd be in tracking who that was.
Are there reports that would show that? I don't think when we looked at this report we saw, like, you know, counterparties actually identified and who was, you know, changing their positions with the company. Do reports like that exist?
I think that material is part of Alvin.
Understanding we don't have those, we haven't seen those reports, we may have them. Do you recall who was pulling money out?
I don't recall any names.
Okay. Do you recall the syndicate or the salespeople telling you, you know, other people were saying, nah, they're not pulling their money out?
Well, just to be clear, I'm making a distinction between pulling money out and not willing to extend further credit.
Let's do both, actually. So, I mean, were there funding counterparties that were saying, yeah, we're willing to roll, or we're even willing to extend additional credit? And you should know, I mean, I'm asking this for sort of the perspective of the issue we're looking at here. It's too big to fail. And we are looking at several institutions, and we are seeing a lot of funding counterparties that arguably or maybe did think an institution was too big to fail, because even though they did recognize name-specific issues with the company, they said, regulators ain't going to let them fail. I'll leave my money in. Everything's fine. Reserve primary fund with Lehman. Oh, with Lehman, of course. Other counterparties perhaps didn't think that and were pulling their money out or not rolling the money. So that's sort of the from where I'm asking these questions from. If you guys saw, in terms of your funding counterparties, different behaviors in terms of whether they were willing to roll the funding or not roll the funding.
I would be focused on will they extend new credit or roll over existing credit. So once we've purchased the debt, it's unsecured and it's ours until maturity. So I would, as a liquidity manager, focused on are they rolling over or not. And there was a decreasing willingness on the counterparties to both roll over and issue longer-term debt. So that's all part of that trend, which, you know, goes way back to market disruption and was starting to accelerate about this time.
Okay, so take me through, with that kind of understanding of where I'm asking my questions from, take me through the rest of the second and third quarter of 2008. Maybe now we're up to the July 22nd earnings release, and I don't know if that's a point where things change and the issues with name-specific risk, you know, ratchets up another notch or not.
The what else? I think IndyMac, we mentioned that a little while ago. That was important to the market's state of mind. And then we get to the Project Alvin kickoff in the May, beginning of June timeframe. And I recall from then until the Q2 earnings, we're just kind of in a bunker. Mm-hmm. We're just taking all the preparations that were approved by the Alvin Management Committee and waiting for the earnings release.
Okay, so you're in the bunker, you've got your plan, the earnings release comes out. What happens? Do you have to institute the plan, or is the impact and on funding anyway, what you guys expected, what you feared? But tell me what happens.
I recall the news not being received particularly well. And Alvin continued after the earnings release because the pressure didn't abate. The name-specific pressure, I recall, increasing. And I think we did encounter a downgrade, or maybe it was a change in outlook. So that tended to confirm our concerns.
Right, but what I'm getting at is I take it you guys institute Project Alvin for the funding side for you guys, and or maybe it was staggered mixed up anyway. But and you do that amongst other reasons in anticipation of how is the market going to react when we announce these 2Q08 earnings. We're already seeing increased name specific risk for funding purposes, and we've seen this steadily declining ability to access the wholesale funding markets. So I suspect there was, you know, we're going to announce on 7/22, and we have certain expectations, or maybe we just have complete uncertainty about what that's going to do to funding sources, liquidity, et cetera. I'm just trying to get an understanding of, well, certainly the news was not good news and was not received well. In terms of a funding perspective and a liquidity perspective, was what happened after that something that was, you know, holy crap, this is way worse than we thought, or this is manageable, or this actually isn't as bad as we thought it might have been, or I'm just trying to get flavor for that.
When we thought about the potential outcomes for the earnings release, we thought it likely that we would have restricted, somewhere between restricted and no access to the wholesale funding markets. So we are going to be reliant on home loan borrowings, balance sheet management, and deposits until further notice.
And what actually happened? Did you lose all access to the wholesale markets, or did you retain some access?
I don't recall specifically, but it was less.
And you don't recall generally, I mean, as you say, you thought it would be restricted or be removed completely. Do you recall if it was removed completely?
I don't recall specifically, but it was less.
Okay. And did you, in fact, then increase Federal Home Loan Bank borrowings and perhaps accelerate asset sales, and I'd have to look at the rest of your funding structure to see what else, you know.
I recall that we continued to access home loan borrowings after that, which was our major source of liquidity besides deposits from then forward.
Mm-hmm. What about deposits? Were you able to, I mean, did you essentially just, you know, a lot of times what banks do, unfortunately, for the banks anyway, in those cases, is you get on the phone and you raise rates, right, and you get the money that way. Was that going on?
There were deposit promotions underway at the time, and I think some were related to the desire to keep deposits growing.
Do you recall if there was ever any, did Wachovia, the holding company, want to, or did it push some of the assets into the bank so that it could fund them through Federal Home Loan Bank advances? Because doesn't that make a difference? I mean, you're pretty much wholesale at the holding company level, and you can do deposits and Federal Home Loan Bank advances at the bank level.
I recall a regular effort to manage Regulation W23AB in such a way that we were optimizing that capacity. That was, I would characterize that as sort of standard operating.
That shows some trend numbers, just from Project Alvin in October 1, but it tracks from July into late September.
So let's just say for the record, Mr. McBride, we're going to show you a document that's Monday, September 29, 2008, email from Estella Atkins to various folks, including you, and it attaches a Corporate Investment Bank Project Alvin, October 1, 2008, Bates Range, 1507 through 1515, directing your attention to page. It's covered by the staple, 1511. So my colleague, Art, tells me this is
It seems to show trend lines for different types of wholesale funding, but I don't know what all the acronyms stand for.
So maybe you can explain this to us, if you know what it is.
After this, let's take a quick 5-minute break.
Sure.
In general, Alvin's objective were to give the line of business units responsibility for reporting what's happening in their balance sheet, specifically what a deposit's doing. So this trend line is deposit activity, and this would be the corporate and investment bank, and then the divisions within the corporate investment bank.
Would these be mainly wholesale deposits then, not retail?
How are you defining wholesale deposits?
Institutional investors, jumbo CDs, not your normal, typical retail.
Not your sticky stuff.
These would look more like credit sensitive type of depositors,
right.
Not exclusively,
right.
But definitely more so than the general bank, which had retail customers.
But those numbers don't include things like, Fed funds sold and things like that.
No, this would be the line of business responsible for reporting to the Alvin Management Committee what's going on with their deposit trends.
Right. Now, you obviously see a deterioration in the numbers. So the aggregate number starts out with, looks like, $54 billion at the top in July and runs down to about $40 billion, looks like, in end of September, if I'm recalling correctly. I don't have it in front of me.
You are.
So would that be sort of consistent with this notion that for, as you say, credit-sensitive providers of liability, you're seeing a drawing down, sort of through this whole period? Would that trend be kind of consistent with what you're seeing in other areas of your wholesale liabilities, from your recollection?
From my recollection, there was deposit diminishment that was occurring throughout the company. So corporate investment bank and general bank.
Okay, so you guys announced 2Q8 earnings on July 22nd and described that there was an adverse impact from a funding standpoint. So take us through.
Why don't we take our...
I'm sorry. Sure. Let's take a 5-minute break.
Hold that in thought.
Thank you. So, Mr. McBride, before we took a break, we were, I think, about... I was asking you... So the 2Q8 earnings release comes, and you had talked about how you guys were in the bunker beforehand and were waiting to see how it shook out, and, in fact, there were adverse consequences with... certain wholesale funding markets going away, other ones, prices going up, et cetera. So if you can, just take me through now from July 22nd through, I suppose, September 29th.
We continued with the Alvin Management Committee meetings, which I recall were either weekly or every other week. And in those meetings, we provide a funding forecast. And the business units would report out on changes to the balance sheet with emphasis on deposits. And there was generally a particular subject matter in Alvin that would be covered in addition to the regular report outs from the business units.
Okay, so these weekly funding forecasts, when did they actually start? When did you guys start providing weekly funding forecasts? Was that a Project Alvin specific activity, or did it exist before that?
I don't remember. We may have used them, in the funding desk, but I don't recall when they actually became kind of reporting documents in Alvin. I think about that time.
Okay. Hold on those. Okay. So, and I take it if we were to see those weekly funding forecasts from the May-June 2008 time frame forward, that would tell us what was going on with the funding at the company. Yes, so I think that those forecasts also show what actually is occurring for prior months or prior weeks.
I actually don't know what they show you.
So you haven't seen them?
I haven't seen them.
Okay. So explain.
I mean, it was 2 years ago I saw them.
Okay. Okay. I thought you were telling me you didn't see them then. So I get that now. All right. Okay, so Project Alvin continues. You're having weekly meetings with weekly funding forecasts, understanding it's been 2 years and you don't remember what the reports say. Generally, what's going on as we work our way through July, August, and September? What are the major signposts or events that you recall that are either funding is staying stable, funding is getting worse? You know, what are the main issues?
I think we've covered these, but I recall little to no access from wholesale funding markets. I recall collateral management issues with FHLB, given reducing pricing and increasing haircuts. I recall a continuing concern about the state of the markets from investors and participants. And I recall us watching deposit trends and listening to the business at the report sessions at Alvin.
And do you recall, in terms of, and I, really what I want you to do is take me through from where we are now, I think, in the July time frame up through September, and as we go through those 2 months, you know, tell me about differences in. Yes, I recall there were even higher haircuts and additional collateral requirements for the advances, or we had to reduce them. There was even less access and freezing up of wholesale funding markets in terms of us and depots and the types of deposits that started to run off or not. That's sort of what I'm interested in seeing, and that I'll then see reports later on that are consistent with what you're telling me, or at least the best to your recollection.
Okay, so we covered wholesale funding markets, we covered FHLB, we covered watching deposits carefully, and we had seen customer behavior from the IndyMac that was concerning. Deposit outflows accelerated during that period of time post-IndyMac. There was continuing sort of what if something happens type of contingency planning that was part of Alvin. And it was maintaining, I think we were running an excess liquidity position at that time, maintaining that to the extent that we could influence it and control it.
What happens, to the best of your recollection, when Lehman fails and AIG are rescued right around mid-September?
added further uncertainty.
You remember sort of a spike like this, or more just sort of a continued sort of slope upwards in terms of conditions getting worse and funding getting more difficult?
I remember both systemic risk meter and name-specific meter going up together in conjunction with Lehman announcement and AIG and Fannie Freddie and those kind of things all continue to unnerve participants. So whether it was name-specific or whether it was industry-systemic, I'm not certain during this period of time, but they were correlated.
And were there, I mean, is that a time where there's even less access to wholesale funding? There's even more collateral being required by the Federal Home Loan Banks. There's additional deposit outflow, whether it's wholesale deposits, whether it's retail deposits, et cetera. That's sort of the feel we're trying to get her. And that's why I said, I understand the topics that you're looking at. I want to know if there's
trend lines
within those as we get closer to, you know, the Friday after WAMU when you guys announce you're for sale and then the assisted deal gets announced Monday morning.
So I don't recall any deposit outflows like what we experienced after Indy following July 11. I recall watching that very carefully. I recall little to no access to wholesale funding, so that didn't change. That continued. I recall, collateral management issues with FHLB and making sure that we were optimizing collateral to pledge against borrowings and to have excess pledge for additional borrowings.
Now, at least our impression is that WAMU, the failure of WAMU was a very dramatic development for your institution. Is that the way you experienced it, that suddenly deposits started running very quickly after WAMU failed?
I recall WAMU being very important to Wachovia name-specific risk, and that Friday being particularly unnerving for investors. Friday after the Thursday WAMU announcement.
So what happened?
That Friday?
Yeah.
Midday, I think, the Seneca desk was concerned that Wachovia credit default swap and was elevated and trading like a jump to default risk. I'm not that kind of, that's not what I do, but that tells me elevated concern on the part of investors about Wachovia credit risk. I recall that a commercial paper trade involving BFCC was returned by the buyer.
They didn't want to roll over.
Well, they bought it and didn't honor the delivery of it.
Oh, okay.
Unusual market participant behavior.
But that neither of these are inside Wachovia Corporation. Both these things, right? The BFCC, that's an external company, right? And so, I mean, what, were people deposits flying out the door? I mean, that's the expression people use.
I don't call deposits flying out the door the next day, and we're not getting, it's hard to get real-time information about what balances are doing because the general ledger is on a delay basis, so we have to rely on the report outs from the business units. I recall, I'm not even sure if we had a call that day, but incoming calls to the funding desk were things like CDS is trading alarmingly high and customers' behavior are very unusual. You had commercial paper not being honored that had been bought. That's very unusual in market activity. So I remember those
things. I don't know what that means. I don't know if that term means honored but not bought, or what is it?
So
they committed to buy it.
Right.
But then they rescinded their purchase.
Right. So securities come this way and cash goes that way. And if they don't send the cash back, you know, simultaneous, then the trade goes, the trade is broken. And so BFCC doesn't get funded. My conclusion as a funding officer was they're associating BFCC with Wachovia and name specific credit risk if they didn't honor a commercial paper trade.
How about the Fed funds sold market? Did you have banks telling you that Friday, we're not going to sell you any more Fed funds, or we're going to cut way back on what we sell you?
We had periodically tested the Fed funds market to see what our access was, and I recall it, you know, slowly diminishing over time. And I don't recall what actually happened that day. I don't know if we tested or not.
Had you been selling Fed funds during this period, or had you almost run out of the ability to sell Fed funds by this time?
With our excess liquidity position, which I recall having maintained through that Friday, we were either leaving it on deposit to the Fed or selling it to participants, whichever was the best rate.
Okay. So, at least in your Treasury office, you weren't experiencing what has otherwise been described as essentially a depositor run. I mean, after WAMU.
I'm not seeing real-time evidence of deposit outflows. I'm hearing from reports in from the business units that unusual customer behavior is taking place.
And can you characterize a little more, other than the broken CMT deal, what was unusual about the behavior?
I don't remember specifically if it addressed deposits or not. But I remember incoming calls that there was a lot of concern on the part of depositors and investors about Wachovia.
And were you hearing sort of like sort of a notion that customers are not going to roll over funding, sort of that kind of general talk, or it was not that specific, that, you know, customers just said they're not going to roll over for us anymore, I mean, roll over funding for us anymore?
The feedback from the syndicate desk and the sales force I use interchangeably was investors are really concerned about the ongoing viability of Wachovia. I participated in a call with investor relations when they were asking just that very question. This was different than prior stress.
This is the first time you've heard customers are concerned about the viability of the institution. You hadn't heard that kind of talk before the day after WAMU.
I had not heard this kind of urgency to Wachovia as I did that Friday.
And understanding the Friday after WAMU, September 26th, that for the first time you're hearing a much higher urgency about the actual viability of Wachovia, what are you seeing, if anything, other than what you just described in terms of funding sources? You've talked about the commercial paper deal that didn't occur. You've talked about, this isn't funding, but the syndicate desk saying our CDS spreads are, our CDS prices are high, and hearing about unusual customer behavior. Is there also knowledge either on Friday the 26th or later, since you might not be getting it in real time, about funding going out the door? And again, I'm asking this from this too-big-to-fail perspective, because on the one hand, you've got folks saying, holy crap, I'm concerned about Wachovia going down the tube, but at the same time they're saying, I don't need to pull my money out because I don't think the government's going to let it fail. You know, that's sort of how we're, why we're interested in knowing, particularly now, since you said there's this increased sense of investors being concerned about Wachovia's viability, is that then resulting in investors pulling their money out of the bank?
A lot there again. I equate investors pulling their money out of the bank similar to, hey, I'm not going to lend you any money.
Right, exactly.
Okay.
Right, exactly.
And the July IndyMac deposit outflow was a concern on my part that it could reoccur following WAMU, which felt closer to home than did IndyMac.
Because the size of the institution was much closer. I mean, it was almost half of yours as opposed to being just a small percentage of your size.
Size, relevance of the portfolio.
The POA portfolio was big in both institutions, yeah.
And concern that investors would somehow equate the two, fairly or unfairly.
And did that happen?
I don't
know.
There
was a short, only a few days.
Did you see anything after the fact? Because you might have gotten reports, you know, after the weekend. After the fact, did you see reports indicating, in fact, there had been a, as you say, a concerted refusal by lenders not to loan any more funds, or depositors, you know, pulling out deposits?
The call from investors to me was convincing evidence that they had that concern, as was this concept of CDS jumping to default. That hadn't occurred yet, to my recollection. Wachovia's name-specific CDS had been elevated versus our peers and trending upward versus our peers, but it had not reached this inflection point described as jump to default.
So the CDS premium that was reported to you was essentially default. The perceived default risk was, do you remember what the percentage was?
I don't.
But it was getting close to almost, maybe more likely than not, the default. The CDS premium is expressing something that almost like more default is more likely than not.
The syndicate has described it as jump to default risk. That's how
it's a jump to default risk. Yeah.
Well, I'm sorry, jump to default risk or jump in default risk?
Jump to default.
Okay.
A jump to default, which means, as you interpret it, more likely than not, or I don't...
I interpreted them saying jump to default as in, you know...
The market is pricing our CDS with the expectation we're going to default. I mean, that's essentially what it means.
Those are the words I would use. Okay.
But this is what I'm getting at. I mean, so you're seeing, you know, the WAMU news comes out. You're hearing this information from the syndicate desk. You're getting investor calls that show a heightened concern about the continued viability of Wachovia. What I want to get a better flavor of, if you have knowledge of it, if, did that then manifest itself into the various funding counterparties yanking their money out or refusing to roll or continue to lend to Wachovia? Whether you learned about it on Friday the 26th, Saturday the 27th, Sunday the 28th, Monday the 29th, and I understand things may have changed because on Monday morning of the 29th, the city deal gets announced, you know, so maybe that calms people down. But that's what I'm trying to get a feel of, if you have knowledge of that.
I recall deposit outflows occurring since July NEMAC, but I don't recall when the spikes were, like after NEMAC, which was pronounced. I don't know from my collection where it became pronounced again, or if it did. I recall that being a very serious concern on the part of the funding team that WAMU was going to look like IndyMac and have the same impact on deposits.
And do you recall whether or not WAMU did have a similar impact on deposits?
I don't recall without looking at something.
Okay. And if you were going to look at something, what would it be?
The Alvin Dex.
Okay. So if I looked at an Alvin deck is like this, what we looked at earlier.
This looks like the line of business corporate investment bank submission into the greater Alvin deck.
Okay, so that's just a piece of the whole thing.
This document.
Yeah.
Okay. Number in there.
Oh, it's the same one we said earlier. Starting at 1507, going through 1515. 92908 email with a PowerPoint.
You have a bunch of the Alvin decks.
Okay, yeah, and I'm, believe me, I know we have stuff we haven't looked at. I think there's also stuff we haven't got.
One of the questions sort of in this discussion of viability, default, so on, was anyone saying something along the lines of, oh my gosh, if they let WAMU go, then maybe Too Big to Fail will not apply to Wachovia. They'll let Wachovia go too. They let Lehman go. They let WAMU go. That means we're not necessarily in the so-called Too Big to Fail club, where we'll be protected in terms of all of our uninsured creditors, or at least uninsured depositors will be protected. Was there some kind of discussion like that going on with the investors or the syndicate test that you heard about?
I recall the conversation being Wachovia can fail. Hence the questions about what's your viability, what's your
right. And was there talk about, well, and we don't know what the government will do if you fail? Was there some kind of discussion like that? We're not sure what the government would do to protect us if you failed.
I recall nothing about what the government would do to stop or prevent or let Wachovia fail.
Right.
Nothing like that. I recall any conversation about it.
Okay, that may close it out, but let me make sure, since I can tell you what we have seen in the documents and what you know to a certain degree. Of course, the government did at least, you know, initially say we're going to approve this assisted bid by Citigroup and not put Wachovia into receivership and do the normal takeover. And I will tell you that from looking at some of the documents from the Richmond Fed and from the FDIC, that, this is the way I interpret it, one of the things they were really looking at was WAMU just went down and a bunch of uninsured, you know, creditors took hits. And now we're looking at a much bigger bank with a much larger extent of uninsured creditors, including mutual funds and broker dealers and et cetera, and they said we're too scared about letting, you know, that many market participants with that much exposure taking hits if we do the normal receivership and don't protect uninsured depositors and unsecured and even secured creditors to a certain degree. Do you recall having any so my question is, first, do you recall any discussions internally at Wachovia about there's no way the government's going to let us fail given, you know, the amount of uninsured liability holders at this bank, or at this company, I should say, not just the bank, but the holding company?
I don't recall any conversations related to what the government would or wouldn't do if Wachovia reached that point.
Okay. And then I take it, did you have any discussions with anybody at the New York Fed, the Federal Reserve, the FDIC?
Let me just, FDIC is the one agency that has not yet authorized us to address bank examiner matters. Why don't you just leave, if you don't mind,
sure.
FDIC?
Sure, let's carve out the FDIC for now. Did you have any discussions with anybody at the Richmond Fed, the Federal Reserve, or the Federal Reserve Bank of New York about...
Or the OCC.
The OCC, about any possible assistance from the government to prevent Wachovia from failing or helping a company acquire them with assistance.
The OCC and Fed had been taking volumes of and requesting volumes of information from us all during the disruption and into the name-specific Wachovia events. They were on site on Friday, the 26th. I recall giving them all kinds of information, but not any discussion like that. It wasn't. I didn't know anything was going on until I went to New York and was told, you're going to be talking to City and Wells about a possible merger.
Okay. And when do you go to New York?
Friday at the end of the day.
And do you talk to Wells on Friday and City Wells and City on Friday or Saturday or what?
I did talk to City and Wells that weekend. I don't remember the exact points I did, but both had meetings with Wells just on the phone and City in person there in New York.
Okay, and I generally, what are those discussions about?
Providing information about liquidity and funding in the state of affairs.
Did they express any concerns about the company's liquidity or funding? Anything stand out?
No, they asked a lot of questions, and we were doing some of our own due diligence, or I was told to do due diligence on the city. Mm-hmm. It was lopsided, though. We were giving them a lot more information than we were getting.
Right. who are you talking? Well, are you? You're talking to City and Wells people. Are you talking to anybody at any government people?
Me?
Yeah.
No government people.
Okay.
And were you talking to sort of Treasury level people at both institutions, or
my counterpart type of people? They were staffed with more, so there were four or five, six people in the meetings from City.
Do you remember seeing anything at City that would have led you to question how easy it would have been for City to acquire you and to make the combined institution work?
To the extent I was doing my due diligence right. on City, it wasn't clear to me because I didn't have enough information.
Right.
And I didn't know to what extent there was systemic and name-specific stress on them.
Right.
That really
you couldn't tell that from the information that you were looking at.
I could not.
What are you doing due diligence on City and Wells for? I mean, was there actually an issue about Wachovia saying we're not going to accept the offer?
I recall being told to do whatever due diligence I could on City, and I don't recall that with Wells, though.
Okay.
And when you say due diligence, what specifically were you looking at with regard to City?
Trying to assess liquidity risk for that company and how it looked on a combined basis.
And what did you see? I mean, what was your estimate? To the, I mean, to the sense you could make one.
Inconclusive.
So would it be fair to say that you didn't come away thinking, oh, this is rock solid. If we merge with them, we're home free.
I couldn't tell. I was, you know, it was lopsided. It was me giving them information and answering questions.
Did you think on Friday afternoon when you left that Wachovia was going to have a liquidity shortfall on Monday morning when you opened for business? That basically you were, they didn't have enough money?
I recall concerns about what would happen next week. And
but your liquidity report at the end of the day on Friday, did it say we don't have enough?
I would describe it qualitatively. Next week would be questionable and unpredictable. I think that's the term we used.
Did it?
With possible reliance on discount window borrowings.
Did any of you ever hear, either from the government, from anyone in the government, or hear from anyone in Wachovia that the government was saying you're not opening Monday as a standalone company?
I recall a meeting Saturday morning, which was the Wachovia due diligence team assembled in the hotel before we went to go sit down with Citi. And David Carroll expressed some concern that the regulators may not let us open for business on Monday. I don't know where he got that information, but he shared that with us.
Just who's David Carroll?
David Carroll was the team leader. Executive management, he ran wealth management.
Wealth management?
Yeah, yes.
But he would have had a view of the whole, you know, funding capability of the company, in other words, yeah.
He would have a view from Alvin Management Committee meetings, right. And my impression was he had a view about what regulators were thinking.
Right. Was there discussion about, well, won't they open the discount window for us? You know, they could obviously tide you over by opening the discount window. Was there a feeling that they might not do that?
I recall concerns on our part about whether the discount window would be available, since that was we understood that to be optional. They didn't have to lend out of Richmond to us.
Did you ask? Did you make a request, I say?
I don't recall asking until we actually borrowed from them a week or two later.
Would that have been something you would do, or was that somebody at a different place in the organization?
It depends on the conditions of the borrowing. If it was just your Fed account short by a couple $100 million and the markets are closed, then the funds trader closing the desk that counts for that day could do it. If it were a large borrowing in light of kind of current conditions, I'd run it up the chain of command.
Did you do that?
Before we did the borrowing a couple weeks later?
Yeah, that Friday afternoon.
No, I didn't do it that Friday afternoon. We borrowed a week or two later. And yes, we ran it up the chain of command.
I mean, did you make the request on that Friday afternoon?
No, we did not.
All right.
You know,
hang on, I need to be clear on something. We had periodic meetings during the day on the 26th with the Fed and OCC team who were on site.
And the 26th being
Friday
after 1 week. Yeah. It's possible, although I don't recall the subject of discount window borrowings, that day or next week occurred.
When Dave Carroll said that the regulators might not allow Wachovia to open on Monday, do you remember any further discussion by people present, like, we can't believe that would happen, or why would they do that to us, or was it just sort of like a statement was made and there was sort of stunned silence that people didn't pursue it?
I recall no further discussion, and emotionally it was shock, sadness, and disbelief.
Yeah.
Did the regulators tell you to go to New York? But what I'm hearing from you is on Friday afternoon, we're all concerned. We haven't asked for extraordinary funding from the government. And then the next thing I know, you're on a plane to New York. I mean, what alerted the organization that something was terribly wrong?
Fed and OCC were on site, so they got to hear everything I've described about conditions for that day, the jump to the fall, the broken commercial paper trade, the concern on the part of investors and depositors. I wasn't told to go to New York by the regulators. I was told by my boss to go to New York at the end of the day.
But was there talk about an acquisition or an investment by either City or Wells before this time, before Friday the 26th? Before the evening of Friday the 26th?
I had been to New York on earlier weekends to do similar sorts of due diligences prior to this one in the city.
So
I was, you know, I was surmising on my own.
Okay. So you were at least a few weeks before the 26th, given the fact that you're going to New York to talk to city folk. You, even if it sounds like you weren't told that City was a potential acquirer or investor in Wachovia, but surmise that from going there and doing whatever work you were doing.
It wasn't City until the 26th.
Who were the other institutions that you went to meet with?
Morgan Stanley.
That's the only other one? Besides Wells and City?
Give him a moment.
Oh, sorry.
An impatient bunch, aren't we?
Sorry.
Goldman was also mutual due diligence conducted by phone, I recall, on the Goldman. Morgan Stanley in person.
And was that in the month of September? Was that even before then? Was it in August?
I recall that in the month of September.
Okay. So is it, to the best of your recollection, potential acquirers coming on the scene doesn't occur until early September?
It's the first time I was involved.
Right.
Yes.
Awesome. And then in terms, and that's Morgan Stanley and Goldman Sachs, and then the City and Wells, correct?
Correct.
And then the City and Wells come onto the scene. Did they come onto the scene before Friday, September 26th?
I was not aware they were on the scene until that weekend.
Okay. You don't get involved with City and Wells until Friday, September 26th.
Correct.
When you're talking to either Goldman or Morgan Stanley in the earlier part of the month, what are they saying in terms of your guys' liquidity and funding position?
I would characterize that as more mutual exchange of information, so dual due diligence. We got to study their stuff in addition to them studying ours. Mm-hmm. More so with Morgan Stanley than Goldman.
But are you talking in addition to exchanging documents?
With Morgan Stanley and Goldman, yes.
So are they voicing, what are they saying? And in particular, what are they saying about your liquidity and your funding?
They're consuming information. They're not really making comments on doability. They're more just processing information we're providing them.
Okay. So they're asking for explanations of data, essentially?
They're asking for explanations of data.
Did you see data at, you talked a little bit about City, but Goldman, Morgan Stanley, or Wells that would have led you to have questions about whether those particular mergers would be, you know, viable going forward based on what you knew?
Morgan Stanley, yes. Goldman, we were in the middle of due diligence when we got the notice that something was going to happen and we were told to break off, disengage. And Wells, we got no information. City, we got some, but like I said, it was lopsided.
And Morgan Stanley, you felt they had, in some degree, problems similar to yours? That one would not necessarily help the other?
I recall expressing concern about my evaluation of their liquidity risk.
Say that again?
I recall expressing concern to my management team when asked about my assessment of the liquidity risk at Morgan Stanley.
Okay.
But Goldman, you didn't get that far, essentially, where you could reach a conclusion.
That's right. But we were told to disengage while in the midst of a conversation with Goldman.
And Citi, it was too much of a one-sided conversation, so you also couldn't make a firm conclusion about, you know, where you and Citi would be together.
Inconclusive. I did not make a determination.
Okay. Yeah. So let's go back to the weekend of the 26th and 27th, and your meeting with Wells and Citi on Saturday the 27th. Are you in New York on the 28th?
That's Sunday?
Yeah.
Yes.
Same thing, just more of the same of providing information and getting information?
More waiting on call than participation.
Okay. Finding out if the deal is going to get done.
Finding out what's going to happen.
Okay. Do you get a call?
I decide that the highest and best use of me and my time is to go back to Charlotte that night and be ready for Monday.
Okay. And so when you go back to Charlotte Sunday, do you go home or, God forbid, do you go into the office?
I recall getting back late Sunday night, maybe even morning, a bad night's sleep, and waking up and hearing at some point about the agreement.
Okay. Yeah, because we know from a 6:30 board meeting at the FDIC Monday morning where they approved the deal. So what happens then in terms of your guys' jobs once... I mean, Wachovia opens for business Monday morning, it does, correct?
It does.
And is there, what happens from a liquidity funding standpoint? Are there problems or is it?
I recall the environment Monday being, if this was supposed to clear things up, it didn't.
Okay, so what's happening?
Everything that I'm hearing from the sales syndicate desk that I'm reading in the paper is confusion on what's actually occurred and when it's going to occur and, you know, who's stronger, who's weaker, those kind of questions.
So in a sense, the investors who are doing your syndicate desk are to some extent giving feedback that, hey, we don't really know whether this merger is going to be so good because we've got some problems with Citi as well as problems with Wachovia. Was that sort of the thrust of some of the discussions?
I don't think I was getting that much detail. I think it was more like, hey, if this merger is going to work, I've got more questions, and it confuses things more than it clears them up.
But were any funding counterparties calling with the confusion of, hey, am I going to take a hit like the funding counterparties to WaMu did?
I don't remember that.
Okay. But that was sort of the whole point of invoking that systemic risk exception, was to avoid that problem. So it would be nice to think that at least that confusion wasn't there, that message at least got out. It sounds like you're not hearing that. And correct?
I would say it's a mixed message. You know, it's on one hand maybe they're to get better together. Mm-hmm. On the other hand, I have a lot more questions and need more information.
Right.
So you could characterize it as positive to some extent, but negative in the context of I don't know what this really clears up.
Mm-hmm. So it would be fair to say that there wasn't the crisis atmosphere you had on Friday, but it was still an unsettled atmosphere on Monday. Would that be a fair comparison?
Maybe I would say it like this. It was continuing crisis because it didn't clear up enough.
Okay. what happens, if anything, with liquidity and funding? Are counterparties not rolling? Are depositors pulling money out? Or is it, is everything, in relative terms anyway, okay?
I definitely wouldn't use okay. I recall, without looking at anything, liquidity outflows. So at the margin, that uncertainty, that continuing crisis condition, bleeded into the next week.
And when you say the next week, you mean that Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, or the following week?
I mean too? That Monday, okay. After the well announcement preceding Friday.
Right. Okay. Okay. So that week, then, you mentioned the liquidity outflows that continue into that week. Do they? Is it a problem, you know, in terms of coming up with funding, or does it dissipate once the market hopefully gets less confused and understands that, you know, there's going to be a bigger merger here and there's not going to be, at least in the immediate sense, you know, uninsured creditors taking hits?
I recall having tried to beef up our liquidity surplus as much as we could. I think we took actions like rolling our securities book in the repo market in order to just address the continuing uncertainty. And working on with IR the message to give publicly about what the merger meant.
And what message were you essentially giving through your investor relations?
I don't remember specifically, other than we were trying to clear up the confusion and address the uncertainty.
It was part of the message, hey, the government's behind us now. The government has essentially expressed that they're behind this. You know, they'll assist this transaction.
I remember trying to get that message right, and I don't know what we accomplished in a finished product.
So, it just generally, in terms of liquidity and funding, does it continue to be an issue? When does it stop being an issue?
It continues to be an issue that week. We are working in good faith with Citi to figure out how to help each other. I don't recall having gotten that message cleared up, you know, in that Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday time frame before the Wells announcement.
Which was the Thursday? Or
You'll have to tell me. I'm not sure.
Right. During this Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday time, are you exchanging more information with Citi and learning more about their position?
I recall that being the same sort of lopsided exchange with them trying to help us.
Right. But you weren't, it says from your point of view, you weren't able to get more comfortable that, oh, I can see this thing working quite well. I can see this combined institution being quite solid. And that you were not able to do from what the information you had.
No, because we never got to the point of looking at a combined funding forecast.
Right.
So I don't know the exact date of the Wells announcement, but did you know about the Wells deal before? It gets announced, before the day it gets announced?
I didn't know about it until I heard it on CNBC.
And then what happens with your role then? Do you just, all right, Citi's out of here now I'm going to start providing a bunch of information to Wells?
I go into work that day very confused about what's going on and waiting for guidance from management.
And what guidance came?
Eventually, it was work with Wells to figure out how to give them whatever they need.
And now, did the investors begin to change? Now that it was Wells, Wachovia, did the investors have a different feeling about whether they wanted to fund this operation than when it was Citi, Wachovia?
it's hard to say when things started changing. My recollection, my impression was it started changing, it started improving after the Wells announcement, but I can't define that with any more specificity. Right.
And where does the borrowing from the Fed's discount window fall in this, you know, transitional period?
I think it's the week following.
The week after the Wells announcement?
Yes.
If we can, let's try to wrap up in like 10 minutes so you could make his point.
We can do that. In fact, Art, do you have anything else?
Bruce, do you have a couple questions?
I do, but why don't we wait for the end?
Why don't you ask them now, and I'll just think about it anymore.
Well, daily liquidity reports, there was some reference to them somewhere, but I wasn't able to find them in the production. Do those exist? What are they? Where are they? Who does them?
Chris and I have spoken about that. I mean, you have some. You don't have all because they haven't previously been.
Are these reports go to the examiners, or are these reports that he produced for himself, or I don't know what these are?
Yes.
I recall that some of them were given to examiners. I don't know with what regularity. I recall some of them being in Alvin. And I don't think there was, I don't recall any other distribution other than what we may have had on our team, and I don't know what that looks like.
But, I mean, did you, for as part of your job function, have a daily liquidity report so you know where you sit every day?
Pre-crisis, that would have been what's in your Fed account. That's your daily funding, and how much debt did you issue, or Fed funds did you purchase, there was a daily one-page report that would look at, but it was really more me talking to the funding desk. What'd you buy tonight? What do we give our Fed balance? It was that kind of dialogue.
It wasn't sort of thing saying, we've got this maturities tomorrow to next day, next week, next month, and that didn't get pushed forward every day?
There were, on the trading desk, Excel spreadsheets that had the funding position and changes that day, and it went out a couple days.
Okay. I guess it's sort of, I mean, same sort of question. We only saw the one report here that they call the monthly liquidity report in the production. Yeah. Are there more somewhere?
For the record, the commission's request was for reports that went up to senior management or to the board. But okay. I mean, we're happy to collect other.
Okay. That means it looks
certainly good. That doesn't mean that only the August 2008 monthly liquidity report went up to management or the board, does it?
Well, in terms of the daily reports,
a monthly report.
I believe you've got the monthly reports,
okay.
but we'll go back and check.
And a question sort of came up when you're talking about. So on August 28th was the time that they looked at, or you looked at, the July 31st liquidity report? And was there a month lag for that production? Always? I mean, it seems.
There was a couple weeks till the meeting.
But you knew. I mean, you knew a lot of the information in a July 31 report before August 28th, right?
I would have known earlier than the meeting day, yes.
And do you know, like, what was the time lag on knowing the daily liquidity position? And I understand it's probably different for different types of accounts. And was there a daily dashboard? I mean, you see those in a lot of companies. It's just sort of, here's the end of the day balances for various accounts.
There was a spreadsheet which had that kind of information on it, and there was a daily electronic dashboard that was in use by the funding desk.
Right, you got to use that just for Fed funds, right? I mean, you got to know what you need to sell or buy, right, at the end of the day.
Yes.
Okay, so. One of the critiques that run throughout the your supervisor's reports over the years was, no IT integration. No IT. So the company had bought up all these companies, and what I'm sort of hearing from you is that we didn't know what all the different entities were doing all the time because we didn't have this IT integration, such that when you went to look at the daily liquidity, you might not know for the whole organization. Is that right? And it would take a little while for everything to come in from the field because it wasn't one big integrated computer.
I would describe the bank knowing its liquidity position day in and day out. Other funding areas were set up to be self-funding, and I may not have as real-time good information on what's going on there. That's true.
One more question. Who's your boss?
When?
Probably in September.
September of 08?
Yeah.
Greg Norwood.
Who's he?
He's the treasurer.
Okay.
At this point, the Fed is already paying interest on reserves, and to some extent you're keeping reserves with the Fed as part of your liquidity management to a large degree or not? I wasn't sure about that.
We were keeping large deposits at the Fed. I don't remember if they were paying interest on those yet or not.
Okay. And then on the Wells issue, were you involved at all with the application for or the extent to which Wells would get TARP funds and whether in deciding what kind of TARP funds Wells would get, what Wachovia's needs were?
Wasn't involved with that.
You know, you have a plane to catch, so we'll let you go.
I hope I've been helpful.
Very helpful. Thank you. Appreciate it. Appreciate your patience.
Y'all have a monumental task.